Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 11th, 2003. Today's session is for the healing of the world, session 5 of The Ethics of Jesus, presented by Jim Hansen, HAJ 2003-05. Let's listen in.
He's going to roll it, Carol, or burn it, I guess. Good morning.
Good morning.
The ultimate session here. It may end up being shorter than even the others have been. It's kind of interesting. I had a little experience of Tanya's living text when I went up to Holden Lake yesterday. I mean, just not in the sense that I did anything to improve it, but I don't think I left it worse. But it was, you know, what it's like here. You just have these almost revelatory experiences when you encounter such awesome beauty. But then this morning I realized that the eschaton is not fully realized. And that came in the form of a fish that I ate that I caught there, and I think it took out its revenge on me or something.
Ooh.
So yeah, I've just had a rough time since breakfast. So if I have to leave quickly.
Bad.
I know, it's sort of ironic, isn't it? Apparently no one else had that experience. I ate the biggest fish, which I didn't choose to eat, so. So for any vegans out there, maybe you don't feel so sorry for me, but I was saying, it serves you right. How would you like to be cooked and cooked and cooked? So really, it's been very uncomfortable. I just say that just because, you know, if I seem a little funny, that's because, I mean, you know, it's because I feel a little funny.
Well, if you run out, you'll know where you're going.
Exactly, right. Yeah, it's too bad, but I'll be fine.
Yeah, I just left door on the right.
Well, you don't have to go upstairs.
No, it's no. Straight down.
Oh, I'm sorry to bring that up, but I just wanted to. I hope I don't have to bring it up, actually.
Well, sometimes we have to face reality.
It's exactly it. I mean, you know, it's like you're reminded that this is beautiful as the world can be. It's not. We're not there yet. But we get glimpses of it. Sometimes those glimpses come back and bite us. Well, I thought this morning we would actually spend the first part of the hour talking about divorce, because A, we didn't get to talk about it yesterday, and B, I think in some ways, even though it's probably the most specific, you know, we've talked more generally about Jesus' social ethics, about his nonviolent stuff, but in some ways it's one of his more specific teachings. He doesn't actually have many rules. He deals more with principles, but this was clearly a rule at some level. Some parts of it are formulated as a rule. But even though it's more particular, it also gets at some of those basic features of Jesus' ethic that we've been looking at. And then, so we'll spend the first part of our time looking at what Jesus taught about divorce, think about, see what some of its implications might be, and certainly talk about what they might be. And then I'll conclude with just some summary comments about what I think some of the overarching themes of Jesus, kind of to recapitulate some of the things from the week. And then we'll have a little time to get your reaction to this encounter with Jesus' teachings. So I think we'll just start by looking at the texts. How about that? I guess this is a smaller group, so it shouldn't be quite as awkward to see. It's awkward to get to, but excuse me, I'm sorry. This is just not... As you can see, Jesus didn't teach much about divorce.
That's it.
Or he taught it in a sandstorm. or upside down. A lot of his teachings were upside down.
You were going to give us a website for where the...
Sure, yes.
And my wife will hit that number.
WWW, which stands for World Wide Web, for those of you who have been home for a long time. NTGateway.com. As in New Testament Gateway. There you will find a huge number of resources. It's a fabulous site. Articles, and more articles. maps. But you'll find, well, you have to do a little bit of searching to find this parallel thing. It's look under Gospels and Acts, I think it is, and then you go to resources. It's fairly obvious how to get there. But when you see the five Gospels parallels, it's put out by people. It's put together by people who from the Jesus Seminar. So they also have the Gospel of Thomas in there, which makes it fun. And you can choose to compare two Gospels. You can have two Gospels on the screen. You can have three. You can have four. You can have all five. And I think he's working on some of the Pauline parallels. Like we'll see. Actually, for this particular issue, we do have a saying of Jesus that's referred to in Paul. So that's the place, and it's really neat. And you can it doesn't do it word for word like this with the spaces, but at every pericope, and these are called pericopes, it will have a little colored Bible for each of them. And if you're in Luke and you want the same passage in Mark, you click on the Mark one, and boop, it comes up the parallel passage. It's pretty cool.
Now, with the maps, do they have ancient maps and current maps?
Yep, they have lots of different maps. See, this is kind of it's a gateway. They just collect other sites. Okay. So you get just about everything. You get pictures of the ancient world,
What frustrates me when you're trying to tell people about the ancient world is they have no concept of where that is.
Right.
If you had an overlay
of
contemporary, the contemporary Middle East, you could say, here's how it fits.
Do people know where Kush is? Okay, so let's dive in here. I don't know if we can even read this, but this is an interesting text, and as I say to the people who just came in, we're looking at a particular issue which I think gets at a lot of the larger issues we've been looking at this week. Interesting, this is complicated because we have I think it's safe to say five different instances of Jesus teaching on divorce. Five different examples, and they are each somewhat different. Let's just read Mark's first. I was thinking, why is there four across there? But there's two. There, it comes up twice in Matthew. Can you read that at all? Maybe
that's
I should
better.
Go like that.
Yeah.
Then we'll look at. I'll move it up.
Mary?
Huh? What?
Tell me to close that shade down.
Huh? What?
Could you close that shade down?
Well, no,
please.
I'll open it so I can close it.
Let's start with I will start by saying I speak as a divorced person. And one who knows the pain that it causes, that the destruction that it can wreak in a person's life and in a community's life. How many of you, I won't ask how many of you are divorced, but how many of you know or have someone close to you or have experienced it yourself? Divorce. Yeah. Okay. Pretty much everyone has either experienced it or has it in their immediate family. So it's another case where Jesus' teachings on, I think, are worth looking at, even if they are somewhat challenging. that's nice, yeah.
That's better.
It's like being at the eye doctor, number one or number two? which is better? Can you read the third line, the third column? Mark 10:11-12, and he said to them, whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her. And if she divorces her husband and marries another, she commits adultery. And if she divorces her husband and marries another, she commits adultery. Mark, now we don't want to presume anything by this, but Mark is the earliest gospel. But, as we'll see when we get down to Paul, Paul, of course, is earlier than the gospels, right, in terms of his writings. Paul's writing, the document of 1 Corinthians is probably 20 to 25 years earlier than Mark. So it's a little confusing. It's unfortunate that Paul preserved so few of Jesus' sayings, because he really is our early. His letters are our earliest written source, but he hardly ever quoted the words of Jesus. So let's just compare that to Matthew, just to get some observations going. Let's see, which one in Matthew? They're pretty similar. Let's look at the shorter one. One of them is in the Sermon on the Mount as a part of a general teaching, and one of them let's get a little context. He said to them, to whom is he speaking? No, he said to them, well, actually, at this point, it is the disciples in Mark. In Mark, he's talking to the disciples in private, but he's just had a controversy with the Pharisees who have said, you know, is it lawful for someone for a man to divorce his wife? And that they're testing him. And that's when he says, well, what does it say? And they say, well, it says in Moses commanded us what? Or Moses said what?
You can write a letter of dismissal.
Right. In Deuteronomy 24, a man can write a dismissal, a letter of dismissal for his wife. And the Pharisees actually were quite divided themselves over how liberally to interpret this. There are two main schools of thought in Pharisaic Judaism at this time. The school of Shammai is a much more conservative one. And for that school, it really was only the only grounds for dismissal of your wife was unchastity, kind of like Matthew. And then there's the more liberal school of Hillel, which people don't quite know how to literally to interpret it, but basically he said the law allows you to dismiss your wife for just about anything. That's what the law allows. It doesn't command you to, but it allows a man to dismiss his wife. We're going to talk about all this stuff in just a minute. So that's kind of the background here. And so these guys come up to test Jesus, you know, and say, is this lawful or not? And what does Jesus say? We do need a little more context, I guess. That's okay. Or have you all fallen asleep? That's always danger.
You know, the word.
Yeah,
this is not one that's covered very often.
He says Moses allowed a man. Mm-hmm. Moses allowed a man to write a certificate of dismissal and divorce her, but Jesus said to them, "Why did God allow this commandment to be, or this concession to be made? Or it's not a commandment; it's a concession to what?
Hardness.
Yeah, because of your hardness of heart, he wrote this commandment to you, for you." But from the beginning of creation, now he goes back and he said, there's an idea here that trumps the idea that of Moses. God made them male and female, but we looked at this yesterday, not for divorce though. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh, so they are no longer two but one flesh. That's he's quoting again from Genesis there. And I neglected to mention when we were using this yesterday. Sorry if you weren't here yesterday. But you know, when we were talking about this as an evidence of Jesus' attitude towards sexuality in general, that he saw it as a part of the created order and not something that was bad in and of itself. I forgot to mention that, of course, what part of the Genesis text about sexuality does Jesus not quote? Interestingly, this is an aside or a parenthesis here. What part? I mean, what does God say? So when God creates the male and female, what does God command them to do?
Be fruitful and multiply.
Be fruitful and multiply, suggesting that the male and female genderization or whatever. That's not gender. That's
gender.
That's gender. Male and female. Yeah. Whatever. That it's for that reason. But interestingly, Jesus doesn't quote that part. You know, it's maybe reading in too much, but he he might be reflecting here an attitude that sexuality is not simply for procreation, that it is part of, and I think that's what the Genesis 2 text as well is actually saying, because it doesn't quote that procreative goal for the man and the woman becoming one flesh. Anyway,
cave, I guess. I feel like I'm on stage here.
You are.
Yeah. Ooh, that was dumb. I just looked right into it, and now I only see spots.
stay away from the light. And then he adds this interpretive comment. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no one separate. Well, that's a case where the gender inclusive translation really doesn't get the force of what he's saying. Because, I mean, the one there is supposed to be what? The juxtaposition there is between what God has joined together, let no
man.
Yeah, human being. It's anthropos is what it is there. And that's what they should have done. And it's that way in the LBW too. Let no one separate. Well, it's just not as powerful as, it's not as powerful as of a juxtaposition. This is something that God has done, and let no human being undo it. You know, it's not a big deal, but it is, I think you lose some of the force. So, it's then that he, in private, now this is different in Matthew, but this is in Mark 10. Then in the house, the disciples asked him again about this matter, and he said to them, whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her. And if she marries her husband and marries, and if she divorces her husband and marries another, she commits adultery. In Matthew,
so the divorce comes later, it's okay.
Huh? Yeah, we'll take this apart in a second. Yeah, these are hard actually to interpret, especially in the dark. But we're all in the dark. In Matthew, this is part of his dialogue with the Pharisees. I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for unchastity and marries another commits adultery. Let's start with, so that's one difference. This is part of his controversy in Matthew. It's part of his controversy with the Pharisees. And then he goes on to that wonderful saying. In private, Matthew's Jesus in private said, you know, if such is the case of a man with his wife, it is better not to marry. We'll come back to that because what is that presuming? That, you mean I have to stay with one wife no matter how much she displeases me? But he said to them, not everyone can accept this teaching, for there are eunuchs who have been so from birth, and there are eunuchs who have been made eunuchs by others, and there are eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. Let anyone accept this who can. So that's only in Matthew, luckily. That's what Jesus teaches in private. It's a good thing to his disciples. So let's just start with, the Matthew 5 text pretty much says this. I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife except on the ground of unchastity, this is a little different, makes her an adulteress, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. All right, so let's just start with some observations here about these three texts. Luke is actually, we won't worry about Luke for now, because he doesn't really add anything. It's different, but it doesn't have anything distinctive about it. What differences do you see that might or might not be significant? Don't worry about if they are or not. What are some of the main differences in those three?
Well, it's just on the action of divorce that the woman becomes an adulteress. Mm-hmm. And it's only if the man remarries that he becomes an adulterer.
Whoever marries, if he marries whom? Are you talking about, which text are you talking about?
Matthew 5.
Right, Matthew 5. And whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery.
But then you go to the Mark 10, it just says whoever marries another commits adultery, she commits adultery.
Right, right. So. Yeah, what do we kind of need to get a definition of?
What's adultery?
What's adultery, right? And traditionally, in the patriarchal society, I know you heard this a million times, but the patriarchal society in which the prohibition against adultery, which is a part of what great body of law?
The Ten Commandments.
Thank you very much. What a sharp crew here. You shall not commit adultery. What is adultery as that was formulated? And probably, certainly in the Jewish world of Jesus' day, what is adultery?
To mine with a married woman.
And so who, against whom is the offense?
The owner of that woman.
Right. The husband of the woman with whom you have sexual relations is the one against whom adultery is committed. So that it's a crime of property, really. I mean, it really is in the ancient world. It's a crime of property you know, it says you shall not covet your neighbor's wife, right, or his house, or his, you know, all of these things. So adultery, strictly speaking, in a patriarchal worldview, is a crime against the husband of the woman who, you know, sleeps with someone else.
Right? Also, and when David is nailed by Nathan, he says, "I have sinned against God."
Right. Meaning,
by what he.
So it's a sin against God as well.
Sin against God.
Absolutely. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
So that means if the woman is single, it's not adultery.
That's right.
Or is it a sin against her father?
No, it's not adultery. It's she may be, she's committing fornication, and I guess he is too, since he's not married to her. But there are laws
to clean that up.
Huh?
Yeah. There are laws to clean that up, the violation of the virgin, or a young woman, you pay the price to the father, and then you're married, and that's fine.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And you can't divorce her.
You can't or can't?
According, you can't. Yeah. If you have a sex with a virgin, then she's your wife for life.
That is
according to Exodus and Deuteronomy. Yeah.
If it's forced.
Yeah, if it's forced. Okay. Yeah.
What if it's consensual?
Then it's paid
for. If she doesn't cry out, it's different. There's a different rule.
Wow. That's the Spanish part.
It's very complex. If she's in the city and doesn't cry out, it means that she didn't really cry out. So she's got the burden's almost always on her.
Okay. Yeah, she's cruel.
Yeah, it's not a very so to get back to your observation, who's the only one? I mean, for Matthew, which of the texts, the two Matthews or Mark, sort of preserves that patriarchal idea of adultery? Or do they all?
They're all patriarchal.
Pardon?
They're all patriarchal. Because they only talk about the man and the woman is an object.
Well, let's, for sure, Matt, the two Matthew texts, because it was also whoever divorces his wife, let him give us, but I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife except on the ground of unchastity makes her an adulteress. Why?
Because she has to remarry.
Yeah, she has to remarry, or else she will be...
She'll have no support.
She'll have no support. So you make her an adulteress because of the way Jesus interpreted the law, that what God has joined together, and that is a permanent union.
It's really lose-lose for the woman.
Absolutely. Yeah. But to put a positive spin on it, remember that this comes in the Sermon on the Mount. So what is Jesus in Matthew's vision? What is Jesus calling his male disciples to? Yeah, to a faithfulness, to a higher degree of faithfulness than the surrounding culture. Because he's saying, don't do this. He's saying, the implicit thing is that don't do this. This is an unfair thing to do to a woman. So don't do it. So I mean, even though it's framed patriarchally, Jesus is pointing out that to do this would not be a good thing, because you would be leaving her destitute. And you are a city on the hill. You are the light of the world. You are to live by higher standards. Unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you won't enter. And of course, don't forget this comes right after the injunction against that adultery. You've committed adultery with someone. If you've what?
Lusted
after her in your heart. So it's definitely a higher standard going here. So even though Matthew preserves the patriarchal setting of this, he doesn't. He is still setting a high bar for righteousness.
Mark is a little peculiar.
Yeah.
In the last part, if she divorces her husband and marries another, she commits adultery. It's only Mark that puts it that way.
Yeah. Yep.
That gives a woman an awful lot of power that otherwise she doesn't have.
Could she do that then?
Well, according to Greco-Roman custom, yeah.
She could.
So let's just note first of all, everyone see how Mark is different. Whoever divorces his wife and marries another is different in two ways, commits adultery against her.
Which one?
Probably his wife. Wouldn't you say?
No.
If I divorce my wife and marry another, I'm committing adultery against
your first wife.
My first wife. But wait a minute, isn't that a lot? Didn't we just say, what is adultery again in traditional Jewish terms? A sin against The husband, yeah. This is really very, very different. And you know, to use that word again, radical. I mean, it is a real challenge to. I mean, there are two ways of it. Well, let's go on here. And marries another, commits adultery. So first of all, in Mark, Jesus seems to be suggesting a much more mutual relationship. That a woman can also, that a woman has sexual rights over her husband, or some degree of rights over her husband, right? Because it's possible to commit adultery against her. Much more egalitarian. trying to avoid words that have double meanings here, but a much more egalitarian streak to it, a component to it. And then, of course, verse 12. If she divorces her husband and marries another, she commits adultery. Of course, he doesn't have to add against him. But yeah, then all of a sudden here, the woman has the right to initiate a divorce. Again, there are two ways to read this. And someone asks, you know, could she do that? Well, two ways to read this. One is that in Jesus' new community, yes, she could. In Jesus, remember we talked about this yesterday, Jesus' challenging gender relations. That is to say, he challenged the patriarchal system by the way he dealt with women and included them as equals and as fully human in his ministry. So one way to read this is that this in Jesus' new community, yes, this is the way it can be. It should be. That there isn't any more of this patriarchal stuff. And of course, that's the way, it seems to me that that's, and that Matthew then has changed this and brought it in line with more traditional Jewish way of looking at it. Not really softening in it, softening it as much as, because we've just seen that he's still enjoining a very high standard of righteousness and fidelity. But doing that within the more traditional framework. The other way to read Mark is a little less, well, maybe it isn't, maybe it isn't. The other way to read Mark is that the author of Mark is the one who's responsible for this formulation because he's writing to a Greco-Roman audience for whom it was lawful for the woman to initiate a divorce.
And Matthew and Luke are writing to a more Jewish population.
Yeah. Those are all inferences, of course. We don't know who the audiences were for any of the Gospels other than what we infer from them. But it is pretty traditional to say that Mark was writing to at least a mixed crew. The thing about that, of course, is that the thing that still suggests something radical about this is that you know, even though a woman could initiate divorce in the Greco-Roman world, it was far from egalitarian. I mean, the woman was supposed to be subservient to her husband in Greco-Roman, most Greco-Roman societies as well. So, you know, I guess because it so comports with Jesus' other teachings about gender, this does seem to me to be likely to have been his actual teaching. What do you think?
I think
the voice of God appeared. Here I am.
Someone might recognize. But what about the arguments that the new community, which didn't abrogate but certainly broke down some of the social class barriers, had Roman, Greco-Roman citizen women entering the community and joining with working class? Anachronistic, but with Jewish, formerly Jewish men of another class, and so the class distinction also enters in here. But women had an upper class woman would have a right with a non-Roman citizen, where she wouldn't have that right with a Roman citizen.
Ah, okay. Yeah, I'm not familiar with that, but it, you know, this is where, and we'll get to Paul in a second, where we do get a we do get kind of a a better insight into the context. That's what we don't really have. We don't have a good insight into the context in which Mark and Matthew were actually formulating this. What was going on in their community? What was, you know, that caused them to shape their understanding of Jesus in a particular way? Whereas with Paul, of course, we do have a pretty good, we have a better understanding of it. But yeah, there's all kinds of, I mean, there's all kinds of sociological stuff going on in these new communities. That's what's so fun about Paul, is because even when we know, and I've known this since my first semester religion course, I've known that the Gospels are much later. You still read them, and you're in the world of the story, which is in the world of before Paul. So it's hard sometimes to remember that, and the indications that the Gospel writers are writing to later communities are subtle and need to be inferred. Whereas with Paul, 1 Corinthians 7. So you also see, of course, the other thing that no one's brought up yet is that Matthew has a clause in there that Mark doesn't. See?
Mm-hmm. Except for unchastity.
Except for unchastity, right. I heard someone say that. Except for unchastity. So, you know, there you can see, that, I mean, clearly for that, it's much more likely that Matthew is accommodating this very harsh saying to, you know, probably the actual practice of his community, where they're, and possibly to Jewish law as well. Hard to say for sure, but you can see it kind of morphing a little bit as it gets applied in different contexts. 1 Corinthians 7 is really, I mean, I'm sure most of you have read it. Bless you. Is that a sneeze? Or do we need to pray? Sometimes for healing. This is where Paul, you know, one of my fantasies is someday to, I guess maybe I could do this if I get married again. however, at weddings, what's the most famous text at weddings?
1 Corinthians 13,
you know, all the love stuff. Well, of course, it has nothing to do with marriage. But 1 Corinthians 7 is where Paul talks actually about marriage. In fact, they're asking him, should we, you know, is it okay still to touch a woman, and even if we're in marriage? And so I just imagine, you know, getting up and to this and saying, well, verse 8, you know, a reading from 1 Corinthians. To the unmarried and the widows, I say that it is well for them to remain unmarried as I am. But if they are not practicing self-control, they should marry. For it is better to marry than be aflame with passion. So the gist of it here is, you know, it's better if you don't do this, but if you can't keep your hands off each other, it's better if you do it.
So.
No way. Are you serious?
Serious.
Oh my gosh. You have it out, did you, I suppose those, I didn't want to presume anything, but it was before the days of videotape.
I do?
You've lost it?
Yeah, we've lost.
Oh. This thing's kind of loud here. That's funny. You've lived out one of my fancies. But it is sort of funny that happens. Paul, not that there's nothing inappropriate about it, obviously, because it's a beautiful description of love, of married love as well. But it wasn't the intention of it. Paul is writing here in response, literally, to questions. And 1 Corinthians is, I think, practically speaking, my favorite New Testament or my favorite letter of Paul. I think theologically, maybe not, maybe Galatians or Romans, but 1 Corinthians gives you such a clear window into the issues facing the early Christian community and how this new life is going to look and the new, you know, completely new structures have to be developed. So they write and ask him in some questions, and that's what chapter 7 starts with. Now, concerning the matters about which you wrote, so Paul is actually responding here to very concrete questions. They wrote that it is well for a man not to touch a woman. You know, in other words, is it okay for us to have to continue to be sexual beings in this new community? I mean, a pretty basic question. And Paul says, well, of course it is. Now, on the way to this, I think we can overestimate, or we can read this too negatively, and fail to see what Paul says, especially in these next verses. But because of cases of sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. Now listen to this. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights, right? Because he's due them. But then he says, likewise, the wife to her husband. Or wait, that's the other way around, isn't it? The husband should give to his wife, right? He even starts with the reversal. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights. In other words, she has conjugal rights to her husband. And likewise, the wife to her husband. I suppose that's the one that he doesn't need to say first. Because for the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. This is where it sounds fairly traditional. But then he goes on and says the reverse. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. So there's this, again, I think maybe reflecting to some extent the ethic of Jesus here. Of mutuality in marriage that, again, would challenge the prevailing... Because everything that you read from the culture of the time talks about how... I shouldn't say... I mean, you never say everything, because someone's going to say from up there... Everything I've read from the culture talks about how, you know, sex is the man is one in charge of sex life, is in charge of religious life, is in charge of, you know, those kinds of things. And so it's again very remarkable to have the text like this. And so anyway, to the divorce part, to the married, verse 10, I give this command, not I, but the Lord. Here we come to the point. Paul is actually aware here of some teaching of Jesus that has been passed down to him. Now again, this is quite rare. Only a couple other places. Probably the lengthiest one is of course in also in 1 Corinthians. His quotation of the words of institution or the Last Supper words, the earliest version of those. What else is there? Is there anything? I mean, he reiterates the love command. You shall love or that the whole Torah is fulfilled through loving, but he doesn't attribute it to Jesus, interestingly. Anyway, this is a rare occurrence. And it basically, the wife should not separate from her husband, right? That basically sounds like what Jesus said. Divorce here separate and divorce are, it's not separate as in, you know, we're separated, that kind of thing, but we're not divorced yet. That's not what's in view here. It's just another word. Could just as well translate it, divorce. The wife should not separate from her husband, but if she does separate, let her remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. Why? Otherwise she'll commit adultery. So you can see Jesus' teaching underlying here, right?
Is the word for divorce and the word for separate similar?
They're different words, but they in the Greek, they're different words in this text here, but they are... But they mean basically the same thing. But you're right, that does reflect two different words there when it says separate and then divorce. And that the husband should not divorce his wife. The wife should not separate from her husband. Suggesting that's possible. You know. What's interesting here is a couple things. He does then say, but if she does separate, and doesn't give any reason why that might be, she just shouldn't marry again. And that the husband should not divorce his wife. Now, he doesn't say the husband shouldn't be married again. Interesting, isn't it? It may be the case, however, that what we're talking about is a particular instance. That is to say, he's not just giving general instructions to the married, but they've written about a particular case. A woman wants to separate from her husband. And that's why she doesn't mention the husband, because, you know, he would if it were a general principle, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So that's possibly the case. And he also has to reckon with the fact that they've written him a letter, which, you know, they didn't have airmail in those days. And not to mention email. So certainly by the time the letter gets to him, he would have been in Ephesus. And the letter gets to him in Ephesus, and then he writes it and sends it back. This could already have happened. So if it's already happened, it's all right, but just she shouldn't marry again. Now, interestingly, he goes on to the rest. Who's left? You've got the unmarried and the widows and the married. And he says, to the rest, I say. But I and not the Lord. Now, this is a really interesting adaptation here. I and not the Lord. What is he doing?
This is my personal thing.
I mean, he's sort of improvising on the theme provided by Jesus here. Well, I say this, the Lord didn't say this, but go
it's
ahead.
A contrast to verse 10.
Yes,
exactly. I, but the Lord, here he says, exactly. Not the Lord, but I.
Right.
So it's just
the Lord, about divorce, the kind of situation that you're talking about, that you've written me about, I have a word from the Lord on this, and this is it. Although he shows himself to be, you know, if she does separate, he doesn't say if she does separate, you know, burn her, expel her from the community.
It's an authority issue.
How do you mean?
Where does the authority to say this come from?
Right. Oh, yeah. This
the
is the authority
second of
one,
the
yes.
teaching.
Right.
In both
right.
cases, verse 10 and verse 12.
Right.
It's an authority issue.
Right.
This is the authority here comes from the
yeah.
Lord, not
right.
me.
Right.
From way on high.
Right.
Not just the second
right.
level.
yeah. Right. Interesting though. Even there, as I said, he doesn't follow it to the letter in the sense that this would somehow make you, if you did this, I mean, Jesus just said, don't do it, right? Except for unchastity, which doesn't seem to be the case. I mean, if Matthew's version is correct. But if Matthew's is an adaptation, then his version is later. To the rest, I say, I am not the Lord. So in other words, this is my ethical reflection based on what I have learned. That if any believer, now here's a very likely situation, that if any believer or brother or sister has a wife who is an unbeliever and she consents to live with him, he should not divorce her. So what's the situation presumed here?
Marriage.
What's the issue here? There's a marriage.
The community is married to the outside.
Right. Or
Someone converted.
Yeah,
more likely,
since this is so new. I mean, this is such a new thing that you have a couple. One of them responds to the gospel faithfully. You know, faithfully. The other one doesn't. You know, just doesn't get it. Whatever. This doesn't make any sense to me.
Elsewhere, he advises Christians not to marry unbelieving believers.
Yeah.
But if they're already married.
Right.
This is advice.
Yeah, I don't think he could wreck. I mean, he can't. Right, exactly. But this is a case where they're married already, and he should not divorce her. And if any woman has a husband who is an unbeliever and he consents to live with her, she should not divorce him. Right? Again, mutuality. For the unbelieving husband is made holy through his wife, and the unbelieving wife is made holy through her husband. Some weird stuff going on here. Otherwise, your children would not be unclean, but as it is, they are holy. He's kind of reasoning from the fact that, okay, your children are holy, right? And you can't get holy children from an unholy marriage, therefore your marriage must be holy. That's kind of his, and he's doing a little, what do you call that? Syllogism? No. A, if A and then B, what do you call that? Syllogism? Is that what it is? Anyway, that's kind of the way he's reasoning. But, look at verse 15, this is the key. But if the unbelieving partner separates, let it be so. In such a case, the brother or sister is not bound. It is to peace that God has called you. So what's going on here when he says that?
If you want a divorce, you better hope that your partner is
a good
people.
Yeah. Somehow I don't know. It doesn't quite seem to be the thrust of the passage to me. I'll think about that one. Turn your partner into an unbeliever and then you can...
That works. In such a case, the brother or sister is not bound. Does that mean not bound to stay together?
Right.
Or not bound to stay single?
Yeah, that's interesting. Because he doesn't say there, then she shouldn't marry. Or he shouldn't marry, but you shouldn't marry if that's remarry if that's the case. That's interesting.
Well, I like the last sentence. It is to peace that God has called.
Right, right. I mean, you don't want to read too much into this. But what is Paul doing here in this paragraph?
by saying, I mean, he's contradicting Jesus' teaching, isn't he?
Yes.
On what basis? Where does he get off doing that?
It's experience.
Okay.
What, bring peace and unity into a family, into a community?
Into a community, yeah.
Kind of like, how's the community going to work in reality?
Right, right, right. There's definitely a sense here of there's a sense of adaptation in light of reality, but there's also a principle at work here. He's not just sort of willy-nilly saying, I don't really like that saying of the Lord, I'm going to do this. It is that, it is the peace that God has called you. There's something.
I've never studied this, but to me he's being a little bit exclusive.
In what sense?
Well, that, you know, you should do this, and you can be holy if there was one unbeliever. But if the person doesn't want to stay,
exclusive.
Then yeah, let them
right.
go, because, you know,
right.
we want to have certain kinds in
right.
the community.
Right. Oh, exclusive in that sense.
Just a little bit there.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. And Paul was. I mean, not exclusive in the sense that you shouldn't have dealings with anyone outside the community, but for him, the community, this was to be the church means, the Greek word ekklesia means called out. This was to be, you know, and in 1 Corinthians 5, he talks about, or 6, you know, this about purging the evildoer from your midst, and there's a lot of harsh stuff. And then in 1 Corinthians 6 is when he lists homosexuality among the things that will bar you from the kingdom of God. So there is definitely Paul was not inclusive in the sense of just tolerating everything.
Well, and that's so, it's so judgmental to me, and I haven't studied this enough, but that's, it just comes across to me. You know, it's not for him to decide, as far as I'm concerned.
But
and how do you know that a person couldn't be changed in a community? That's what it's, where it's supposed to happen. It's supposed to happen at the communion rail.
Mm-hmm.
We're not supposed to be doing it.
I think that's part of what he's saying. Husband, for all you know, you might save your wife. Wife, for all you know, you might save your husband. And so he's sort of saying, well, this would, it'd be better not to let it happen. But it, notice who's to initiate. It's if the other party wants to initiate. In other words, you shouldn't initiate it. Yanni, you want to say something?
He's being very, he's contextual. He's talking
yes.
to certain questions and...
Yeah.
And a specific time and place. And
right. Yep. Yeah, I think that's a good word. He's being contextual. And that's kind of the question that we want to turn to for in our last few minutes here is, as we back up a little bit and say, well, and that's part of the reason why I wanted to look at this, is because it gives both the high demand of Jesus and gives us a sense of the radical challenge that Jesus' ethic posed for his followers in his context, but also some ways in which you begin to see that radical ethic being contextualized in the ongoing life of the community. And so the question becomes at the end here, to what degree can that happen? I mean, we've contextualized it, especially probably we Protestants anyway have contextualized it to the point where it's almost secondary to the cross. We contextualize it in light of the cross and resurrection and the message of grace and that kind of thing. That brings us back to our first session, for those of you who are here, one day, I guess. We can turn that off so it's not so loud. But you had a hand up.
Oh, so. That's okay.
No, what were you going to say?
Basically, she said it. I was just going to say, I think, when I read these texts, I often don't think about Paul's just, you know, he's struggling to hold this kind of... community together, and he's finding out these issues, and they're writing him about what do we do. And
right, right.
So, and then I read it as like, so it, that's what I never know what to do with all these things.
Right.
It is in a context to it.
Right, right. So what do we do? Let's see. Where are those lights then again? So we can spend our last few minutes here, at least in some degree of light. So what do we do? I guess I'm interested in your reaction to, granted, and so not everyone here has been here, or this might be the first session for some of you. I'm sorry if this seems a little, whatever. This is our concluding to a series.
And yet each session is supposed to have an integrated, or a, what's the word? I don't know.
Be a whole.
Yes, be a whole. In have its own integrity. But for those of you, and obviously this isn't the only place you've encountered Jesus' teachings, I hope. But what is, as you've thought about them this week or in the last couple of days, or in your life, what is your sense to return back to our original question? To what extent does Jesus' ethic give us a viable pattern for life? What extent does it more or less show us how much in need of God's grace we are, and thrust us on the cross and resurrection? What have you had any thoughts along those lines as we've looked at some of these issues and texts this week, or again, whatever, in whatever context you've looked at them?
I always question, in reading these, most of the texts say, if the husband divorces, mm-hmm. but if the wife separates. Mm-hmm. Now, is there some reason for that?
No, the language here is both effectively mean divorce.
It does mean divorce. Mm-hmm. Well, I was wondering if maybe if she was still able to inherit the property, or et cetera, if she didn't divorce but just separated.
Yeah.
It could, I would say, interpreted in that way in a certain respect.
Yeah. I mean, that's to what extent? Maybe it's too broad a question. Maybe we should just we can start with the question of: do you think Jesus' teachings on divorce are things that should be paid attention to? If so, to what extent?
Well, most people, I think most people in this country remarry. Mm-hmm. People that get divorced remarry. Mm-hmm. So that's what's usually happening.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a different context. So how do we interpret that? The change in context.
And I think it was a lot of an economic issue. The property and the wife would be without any means of supporting herself, less mm-hmm. changed. And I think maybe in the cases where the wife was divorcing, maybe she was the one with the property. Mm-hmm. That was a
Was it an issue of, like you were saying, is it an issue of protection?
There's a dimension of protection for sure. I think what Jesus is saying, do not divorce your wife, he's saying don't leave her out in this patriarchal culture on her own. There's definitely an aspect of that. And yet the argument that he makes, that's not the explicit argument he makes, of course. The explicit argument he makes is that this is what that marriage is a creation of God, that God brings two human beings together in a way that creates a new creation, something that didn't exist before, and that divorce undoes that or sullies that, thwarts God's intentions. This is what God intended for creation. That's what Jesus turns to. He turns to, in effect, he doesn't just give a rule, in other words. He appeals to what you call sort of the symbolic world, the story world. In the larger story, this is God's intention for marriage. And any deviation from it is a thwarting of what God intended for creation. So I don't know, I mean, certainly there are practical reasons and the context is different. But it's hard, I mean, he appeals to such a fundamental principle that it's hard to see that in that way. But do we need to contextualize that and say, well, that was then, this is now? Or do we need to re-examine our own attitudes towards divorce in light of Jesus' teachings?
Can we do both? You want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, but there's also more context to Jesus than you can deal with in a week or a semester or a year. We didn't get at how he talked to the woman at the well. You've had several husbands, and the one that you are with now is not.
Right.
and yet there was no explicit judgment against her,
right.
But an acceptance that she too had some opportunity to be part of the community.
I don't read that, though, necessarily, that she's been divorced all those many times. I think it's another way into that story is to see her as having been widowed that many times. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to me that the tradition of the church has made her a somewhat of a loose woman. Yeah. And I think there's another way to read that whole John 4 chapter as a widowed woman who's the kiss of death now. Right. And that's why she's not married to the man she's living with, and why she's coming alone to the well. And that it's out of grief of having married all these husbands. Perhaps. But it's interesting to me that the church has made that more read sexuality in that text.
It's the same with Luke 7, the woman who comes in. It doesn't say at all that she's a prostitute or a loose woman or anything. That's something that we've inferred. But there is the woman caught in adultery, whom Jesus. This is where this really gets tricky. Is that definite? I mean, part of the contextualizing, of course, is contextualizing in terms of the canon. None of these commands of Jesus are isolated, at least in the canonical gospels. There are those, as we talked about earlier in the week, there are those who think that there were early communities that basically just tried to live out Jesus' commandments and didn't pay much attention to the whole death and resurrection thing. Obviously, though, the church decided that the two pieces had to go together. So, I mean, the question is how to say that without it being a cop-out. How to say what? How to say that the context in which Jesus makes these commands is, in fact, the context of a story which ends in his death on behalf of others. And to take that more widely into the canonical context, into the whole New Testament, that's the context in which we hear these radical commands. How to take the command seriously as well as the grace seriously. That's the real trick, because as soon as you start to say, well, yes, I'm divorced, but God still loves me, then it's easy then to begin to think, well, the commands don't really, it's nice if you can do them, or maybe there's some people who can, but I can't. The fact is that Jesus, as preserved in, I would say, pretty much all of the gospel tradition, certainly the synoptic tradition, did have a pretty high estimation of what human beings could accomplish. I think he knew that we weren't perfect, but he did have a much higher estimation, and I think we need to, I do have just a couple remarks here that I could actually look at my notes here. I think that there are certain things, certain aspects of Jesus' ethical teaching that I think we do need to take very seriously. And I need to find a better way to put that. What does it mean to take very seriously? It means to try. See, then it's very difficult. I'm working on it. But very difficult, because I don't want to say try as hard as we can and then grace comes in, because that's not it either. But just a couple things that I think I want to highlight from what Jesus taught. First of all, the continuity of the message about and of Jesus with Israel, that there's much more than just the relationship with Israel here, of course, but it has to do with God's promises, that Israel is elected, that we can't understand Christianity without Judaism, and we should not understand Christianity as having superseded Judaism, because that was not part of Jesus' teachings at all. That was not his intention. But it also then opens the way towards, there's a principle at work there that opens the way towards a Christian attitude towards other religions, which is a whole other thing, obviously. One of the most important things, the reversal of normal conceptions of status and power that we tried to highlight in some of the texts, especially on Tuesday, I think, that the kingdom belongs to the poor, the outcast, the weak, and the children. And wherever the church becomes acclimated and deferential to conventional human authority that rests on other values, it has lost continuity with Jesus. And I think that's a critique that we just need to level at our churches and at their relationship with our culture.
Where's that quote come from?
What quote?
Or did you come up with that on your own?
It's a paraphrase of a guy named Richard Hayes. Mm-hmm. The centrality of the prophets, I guess, would be a third thing. And read not, and this is really key, read not as, the way we often read them is that the judgments of the prophets go to the unbelieving Jews, right? Because they're the ones who are stiff-necked, and the promises of the Messiah go to the Christians. The prophets need to function within the church as a prophetic voice, as they did for Jesus. So, I mean, I think that, and Jesus clearly sets that up as a pattern. And I know a lot of people do read them. I don't mean to suggest that the church never does, but I think we often forget that that's how they were meant to function for Israel. It's an amazing thing, and it's a scandalous thing. It's an amazing thing that Israel preserved in its in its literary legacy, the Bible, that it's so much of it is self-criticism. It's an amazing thing from the beginning, you know. We lost the land. We didn't keep the covenant, and the prophets and those who point out all these weaknesses of Israel. It's an amazing thing, as well as counter voices. Obviously, I don't know if you were at Jonathan's Bible study about Job. I mean, it completely contradicts it. What Christians have done, what the church has done, is to take that self-criticism and turn it against Israel, and say that's God has judged you. And to preserve that sense of self-critique that the Hebrew prophets had, that Jesus was central to Jesus' ministry, I think is crucial. Jesus' rejection of violence, I don't think there's much ambiguity that was Jesus, and his call to love the enemy, that was Jesus' way, and that needs to be taken seriously. And I know that's a whatever way to put it, kind of an easy way to put it, but it needs to be a hallmark of the church, I think, that is up there. And finally, Jesus' death on the cross. To be, I think this, looking at Jesus in this way forces us to see it not just a gift from God for our salvation, which, again, I believe it is, but a challenge. Insofar as to the degree that the community of faith, it challenges the community of faith, it says to the community of faith that to the degree that it is faithful to Jesus, the cross might be the result. It's not calling people to suffer for suffering's sake. It's calling people to live out these values in a world in which these values, in a world that is hostile to these values. And that has been that it's going to result. So, I mean, people say, well, does this mean I have to be suffering or I'm not a true Christian? Well, again, it's not the suffering that, you know, it's not like the guys on Saturday Night Live who took an ice pick and, ooh, I hate when that happens. You know, like, I don't know if you know what I'm saying, that bit, but I always think of that, just like pain for pain's sake. That's hardly the case. And as I said the other day, Jesus doesn't say bear your cross, he says take up your cross, which is a totally different image. So I say this, and again, to bring it back full circle to where I started, that this is an uncomfortable topic in many ways, but I think if we're not suffering for the sake of the gospel, we need to examine why that is. Not everyone is called to that kind of service, but we need to say, well, what does that mean that I'm not? What does it mean that I'm not? I don't mean that in a condemning way. I just think that we need to reflect on that. What does it mean if I'm not?
We're children of the king.
Yeah.
So we should go back to Christ.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, the other thing to remember, of course, is that Jesus wasn't just apparently had a lot of fun and was possessed as well of the joy of God. So it's not that we need to be, he was, again, a glutton and a drunkard, suggesting that, I mean, not that he was, but he was called that, suggesting that he, you know, he knew how to let his hair down, so to speak. So the key is, again, to reflect on how to highlight this ethic in a way that, in a balanced way. I guess the final note I'll leave you with, I think there is a parable that comes close to doing this, And it sort of reverses the order, which I think is probably good and more Lutheran. It's the parable of the unjust steward, is that what it's called? The one, the unjust slave. The one who, the wicked slave, or whatever. The one who owes his whole life to his master and has no way out other than his master's pity. I mean, he has no future, he has no life apart from his master intervening on his behalf, which the master does. I mean, and that, of course, would be grace. But then, you know how the story goes, right? Then he goes out and doesn't act out of that new reality that's been created for him. And he demands his fellow servant to pay him the few pennies and throws him in torture. Or puts him in prison until he's paid the debt. I just have to read this because it's such a great line. At the end of the parable, I don't know if this is a good line to leave with or not, but at the end of the parable, Jesus says, and what did the master do? He went out and found that, it's in Matthew 18, he went out and he found that wicked slave and said to him, "You wicked slave, I forgave you all that debt because you pleaded with me. Should you not have had mercy on your fellow slave as I had mercy on you?" So, I mean, there's that principle. It's not a perfect way of working out, but it does kind of show you a possible way to relate the two. That a new reality has been created, and not that this is a once and for all thing either, but a new reality has been created out of which we are to live. It's not just for our own sake. "Should you not have had mercy on your fellow slave as I had mercy?" And in anger, his Lord handed him over to be tortured until he would pay his entire debt. Which of course means for how long? Oh yeah, you don't make much money being tortured. And then the punchline here: "So my heavenly Father will also do to every one of you if you do not forgive your brother or sister from your heart." It's just such a nice little pearl that Jesus reminds us that yes, there's grace, but there's also demand. I guess is the way to put it. Yeah.
That's the reason we Presbyterians use debts.
Yeah, right. It's a nice reminder of that. Anyway, gone over. Oh boy, we've gone over. Sorry, but thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.